This is a subject which I think it can be said is extremely interesting and important and significant to young people. I've had a chance to talk to a great many different kinds of groups, and I'm really amazed at the amount of interest that young people show for this particular subject. Now, that's not too strange, I suppose, because after all, they inherit this world and will be performing rather significant roles in the next couple of decades. And this is really has something to do with futurology, more immediate futurology, to be sure. But they're very sensitive to the kind of problem that's developing. And I think many of us who have been living in this world a little longer look upon the problem in the same kind of dimension or scope as we saw it developing, for instance, after the Second World War. And we kind of dismiss it from our mind. If the problem is developing, we always can face it with another Marshall Plan and so forth. Somehow the youth sense that isn't going to be good enough in a question like this. And I think many of them, at least, are hooked a little bit like I am by the dimension of this problem as maybe a primary issue. I would, of course, unequivocally say it is the issue of our time, as some others would say. And so youth sense that this is a priority issue. I suppose that's the reason, for instance, that I'm not very keenly interested in radical theology. I'm amazed, still am amazed, at the amount of disinterest among young people for the whole school that's called radical theology. They just never got turned on by it. Now, these are maybe can be explained in certain psychological ways, and yet I'm not sure that they don't say something about both young people and about the kinds of problems, the way they look at them today. And so I have to enter a disclaimer. Of course, I'm not a biochemist or a demographer or an agronomist or an economist or any of these things. I'm a generalist, and I don't apologize for that, because there are many people who are saying again today that what is really needed are more generalists in this whole area. Not maybe the scholarly kind of person, but the one who looks a little bit at all of this as a layman and says this is a concern, we have to face it in whatever way we can. As long as Paul Hayne isn't here, I can paraphrase Talleyrand and what he said about military men. Maybe economics is just too important a matter to leave to the economists. And so I think this is part of the whole business. Now, in some of the sessions that we've had in the afternoon, we've talked about facts and figures, and I'm not going to bore you with many of those today. We haven't talked really very squarely about the whole biblical theological background that gives hunger, I think, a particular meaning to the church. And I don't pretend to go through the whole scriptures and try to outline a detailed theology. I've taken a couple of cracks at this in a couple of papers that have been prepared for Lutheran World Federation, which are just putting out in a book, by the way. This is the only commercial that will come, called Justice in the Developing World. It's being sent now all over the world in several different languages in order to try to get study groups, young youth and adults both, involved in this, and then we're going to get the reactions back before the LWF Assembly in Porto Alegre in 1970. We've already gotten the first round, and it's been a very interesting kind of a thing. That goes in, by the way, into a package, second commercial, goes into a package which we call an issue box. We put out one on the whole black power ratio question, and now we're putting out one on the population race, or population food race, and that's out as of today, unless our deadlines are not being observed in the office while I'm gone. So if you happen to be interested in this, there's a lot of material, of course, that can be had here. We've tried to cull through what is the very best we could find in very many different kinds of forms and from different parts of the world, and put it together in one box for those that want to tackle this as a subject and a concern. Now, as far as the whole biblical matter here, I think there are certain themes and motifs that go through the scripture that give us a strong basis for this, and I think you know certainly what they are. I would start with saying something about the way, particularly the Old Testament, affirms the goodness of God. We got into a little discussion earlier about the difference between the Hebrew and the Greek way of thinking, or the Oriental way of thinking and the Western way of thinking. And I think this shows up very much at this particular point. The Old Testament just exudes with affirming that this earth and this world that we're living in, that which God has given us as his gifts, are real and good, and we need to praise him for it. Somehow we have gotten into our heads that, you know, the world is evil and we ought to shun it and be away from it, and I suppose we're talking more now about involvement in the world. I'm not sure we all realize what that means when we talk about it, but I live with Jewish people most of the time and do a lot of working with them and so forth. And I'm amazed at how they are able to capture this whole theme of the goodness of the earth. There are all kinds of examples of this. I suppose one of the classical ones is in Deuteronomy, all the way through the book, as a matter of fact. But in that book, for instance, in the 8th chapter, for the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks and water, of fountains and springs flowing forth, in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, and a land of olive trees and honey, a land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron, and out of whose hills you can dig copper, and you shall eat and be full, and you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land he has given you. Well, there are, of course, examples of that all the way through the scriptures. But this celebration of the goodness of God and of the earth that we enjoy is something that has to be said, especially when our first response to this whole business is to kind of look at it grimly and sort of feel guilty about all of the good things that God has given to this much blessed land. And the first thing that we want to take, of course, is, well, let's agree in the family now that we're going to fast at least on Friday nights and that sort of thing. Now, I'm not against this if it can be a symbol, but obviously it's a very weak symbol, and it doesn't take into consideration this part of it either. And I've been rather strong about stressing that side of things, because I think the developing world also needs to see that simply because God has given us this fortunate land to live in, you know, the response can't just be to go around with great guilt on our shoulders and in our hearts about the goodness of God. There's another motif that is not different from it, but is of a different nature, and that is one which we often refer to when we talk about social issues, and that is, of course, the decrying by the prophets, particularly, of injustice of any kind. Whenever the world develops in such a way that there are the very, very rich who are getting very much richer, and the poor are actually stumbling and falling and becoming going deeper into their poverty, then the prophets rose up, and as you remember in Amos, makes references about the cows of Bashan and all the rest. I don't know who he's referring to there, men or women. I can't ever remember that. I try to conveniently forget it. But he's very strong in his language about that. And of course the prophets are replete with this kind of word. We need to remember too, of course, and I suppose especially in the modern church, that Jesus was a poor man. He lived as a poor man. More than that, of course, his main identification, you don't need a great deal of perception to read through the Gospels to see that his main identification was with the outcast of society. I don't think it can fairly be said that the church's chief preoccupation, the church is saying constantly to itself that where the action is where the outcasts of society are. Who really can receive and are hungry and thirsty for the gospel, who also happen to be poor, you know, physically poor. Our Lord fed the 4,000 and the 5,000, not some esoteric kind of food, but he fed them bread. He fed them real and actual bread. much could be said about this in terms of the pastoral epistles. Also, they particularly bring up both these themes, the goodness of the earth and also the justice of God in his economy in the earth. Paul said this in just a little different way, and perhaps brought both patients together in a word that came again and again coming from his pen, that whatever state he was in, whether he was abased or whether he was exalted, there he could rejoice. And so you have, I think, theological strands running out of this whole business. I think we need much more emphasis on a theology of affluence, of what it means to live in a land that has gained in affluence beyond the wildest expectations of only a few years ago. How much we've increased. As the Savior mentioned yesterday, what has happened to his family over these last 100 years. And of course, it dramatizes the importance of seeing that our grandfathers were not so very wealthy and had not enjoyed even what we've enjoyed. Or a theology, of course, of justice, which is much more refined at this point, a just love, in other words, and that's what we build all of our ethics in the Christian church on, and we, I think, need to emphasize this again and again. This is a part of our message. In fact, I don't think it's just some sort of an ethical addendum, it is an integral part of the gospel in our day. And I think we need to develop a theology of power. We've heard a lot about that. We hear a great deal today about this in terms of churchmen getting involved in political systems. And I think we have made some rather serious mistakes along this line. I think it's interesting that whether you read Harvey Cox or someone like this, there's no word that says, yes, the Christian has to be involved in political life, but it is of the nature of the Christian gospel that whatever he is and wherever he works in political systems or in power structures or in the establishment or whatever, in a sense, he still works as the powerless one, as the one who is following the powerless one. And so it seems to me that we need to have a kind of a word of judgment. We need to build into whatever political activity we have a sense that we ourselves shall also be judged. And I think especially in a day when revolutionaries are rising up on all sides of us, we need to see that every revolution, no matter how good it might be, every revolution is a penultimate revolution in terms of the Christian church. Well, especially do we need a theology of development. And here again, I think it's easy for us to fall into the traps of saying that development has something to do with progress, for instance. It has nothing to do with progress, at least in the biblical terms, I don't think. It has something to do with the quantity of life that is around us. Rather, of course, it has much more to do with the quality of life that we live. And this is, I think, a theology that can pull directly out of the scriptures and can give us guidance in the tremendous dynamics that are operating in the world right now. Well, that's not a very good review of some of the biblical theological themes, I suppose, but I think at least they're germinal for giving us a little structure to the way we think about this whole problem. The other thing I think needs to be said about what I choose to call international economic justice is that there has been a whammy effect of unconcern, particularly in the USA. Now, that does not mean that there aren't some very concerned people running around about this and some very competent people. There really are. But they're an elite. And it's a very maddening thing to find that these elite come together for conferences all the time. And they talk about this in very sophisticated terms, and they know what they're talking about, and they know what at least some of the things that need to be done. But this is not very pervasive to our particular society, I don't think. It was interesting for me, I was in England last month for a little bit, because I was visiting an outfit that's called Oxfam, which is perhaps the most sophisticated church organization that's working in the whole matter of development. And while there, I visited with our next door neighbor, who's a University of Minnesota professor, who's over there doing some lecturing and so forth. And that's the first thing he said to me, we used to sit and talk about this a little bit, and he said, He says that everybody in the United Kingdom seems to be all involved in the whole manner of development. He says every British housewife and every youth around seems to be all turned on about this subject. This is the primary subject. And he's really quite amazed at how much interest there is. If you go up above our borders here into Canada, you'll find exactly the same thing. They just completed a whole series of marches that raised millions and millions of dollars for this, for some kind of development programs by March for Millions, as they call it, in which they get 300,000 people to march through a city and maybe for 30 miles. And it's really quite a phenomenon that was developed there. The Netherlands and Europe and all the rest have really done this too. Yes? No. This has had a lot to do, for instance, with the Oxfam movement. There's an Oxfam of Canada, for instance, which has sponsored a great deal of this. The Oxfam of England, the Shalom movement in the Netherlands, which is a Protestant Roman Catholic group that have really gotten out and propagandized the people about the concerns. So it affects, you see, political life. It affects what they do as a church, their priorities, and the way they think. The German Protestants and Roman Catholics have also combined, especially the youth movements, in looking at this. In Scandinavia, this is a subject that's well known. So all over Europe, you find an interest here. What's been blanked out here, we know a little bit about this by reading a guy like Michael Harrington, who just says it's endemic to the poor to be invisible, and it's endemic to the rich to make them invisible. But of course, this dimension of the whole worldwide scope of the problem is even more true. I have to say a word of judgment, which I'll get clobbered on, I guess, and I don't say it very loudly, but President Kennedy did set up something which has become the main propaganda tool around the world. The Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations started about 8 years ago, when Kennedy came into office, the Freedom from Hunger campaign. And along with that is the Young World Food Appeal and things that especially appeal to young people. And he set up a Freedom from Hunger Foundation, and he chose people who happen to be heads of church relief organizations to form the board for the Freedom from Hunger Foundation. Now, I don't know what you say about this. The intent was clear that this was to be set up in every state. It was to permeate through every community in the United States. There was to be a cooperative ecumenical endeavor that, you know, was to really awaken the people at least about knowledge about this thing. There is one Freedom from Hunger campaign group. I met with them a few weeks ago. They're located in Northern California. They're a group of about 12 people, most disparate group you ever saw. There's one Lutheran young person that I'm proud to say. But most of them are secularists. Some of them are not interested in the church at all. That one little group, which has, you know, had its impact, but nothing in what was envisioned. Now, you draw your own conclusions why that's true. It's frowning, and I think that we have to face it rather squarely, at least. And so we kind of look around and we say, like the popular journalists say, it's a terrible problem, and they point out the drama of the problem, they overstate the facts usually and all the rest of it, and then they say at the end of the article in the newspaper and magazines, of course, there's a breakthrough right around the corner. I can almost lift that sentence out of those stories. It comes into everyone. And yet, the responsible scientists in all of these different fields that are involved would not share that kind of optimism at all. I told it a little bit like, you know, the man who falls out of a 30-story window, and as he goes down, he's heard to say, passing the 13th, everything seems to be going just fine right now. And I think we're a little bit built that way, particularly in this country, not only because of our optimism, but some other factors. But I think there has been a sort of a blanket that's formed, and we really haven't come to grips with the thing. I would call it to paraphrase again, William Temple, for his time, the great fact of his time was the ecumenical movement. And I think the great fact of our time is this developing hunger that is coming into being. And it's related, interestingly enough, just to point up the matter of priority of issues, I think it's related to all the major issues that we have to face today. maybe illustrated by simply looking at the racial question, which is burning us literally in this country. The question, of course, between the developed world and the developing world, or the third world, that world made up of Asia, Africa, Latin America, this area of the world is largely colored. And if you have met some of those people recently, you know that they don't cotton to Americans very quickly, or they don't cotton to British or to French very quickly. And it has a whole history of colonialism that's involved. And the racial question becomes extremely important. And the supplements for much of what we call the Black Power movement today has come not from devised kinds of philosophy here in this country, but it's come from men who have spent some time in other parts of the world. As you know, Malcolm X, of course, went and it flipped on him. He went over to the Muslim countries and came back preaching a word that was completely different than he preached before. This was just before he died, saying that I now know that I can live with my white brothers. And yet, of course, he saw very deeply that this was a racial problem, and that there is something about what the Colonial Report calls white racism that tends to keep the colored races down simply because they are not of the quality that we pretend to be. So it has some dimensions here. Stokely Carmichael, who's probably lost now because he's married into wealth, but is a man who's seen this very directly, the relationship between the black man in this country and the colored races around the world. Or you take the urban crisis, and with all of its dimensions to its problem and the way we look at it, we somehow have not been able to do what Europe has done and been able to get at our ghetto problem. But when you look at our ghettos, which are very, very bad, you look at our ghettos and then we begin to look at the great cities in the developing world and the favelas of Latin America, for instance, where in Rio 5,000 young people are coming into that city a day, and it is the most horrendous kind of poverty conditions, and that is mounting all the time, of course. And so you have a great urban world developing that is even a more complex problem. Or you could talk also about the rural crisis that we know here in this country. It's, of course, even more acute overseas because about 80% in the developing world are employed or have been on the land and as peasant cultivators. And that problem is becoming very acute. Most people would say that the place, if you want to give your money to one place, I was very nicely given a gift of $800 to do with what I wanted to, and I looked through all of this business, and the one place that I think people who really studied this say is the greatest need for the out-of-school rural youth around the world. So they have no chance for education, not only because of their poverty, because of the burgeoning population. Whatever problems they had in education before are just, multiplied over and over again. And so these out-of-school rural youth who have nothing to do, in the rural areas, of course, are marching into these great cities and finding even a worse situation there. Or the question of war and peace. I often, kind of think a little bit about the fact that we are all caught up in the intricacies of settling this Vietnam issue right now, and whether we come up with some kind of a coalition government or whether we come up with a different approach to this problem, when you start to realize that in 20 years, which isn't so very far away, that there will be almost a billion people over in India, we had a map, and then over in China, there will be over a billion people pressing in on those lands. Well, the only place that overpopulation can go, if it's going to migrate, and it's bound to migrate some, is, of course, into that Indochina Peninsula, and the people will just flood into that area. And suddenly, the delicate balance that we've got there now is going to, I'm sure, be greatly affected by this particular expansion. So, it is an issue that I think is related in a peculiar way to a lot of other issues that we become terribly concerned about here in this country. And for that reason, I think it's important After all, if it is the greatest problem that mankind has ever faced, I hope for that reason alone, it's a problem of first priority for the church. Well, there are many ways, of course, of looking at this question. It needs to be broken down into some of its component parts, but as we were reminded yesterday afternoon, when you pull out one component part, everything else changes, and that's true. It is a food problem, to be sure. We would say, first of all, it's a nutrition problem, and we who fight the calorie problem, I think, are not as conscious of the fact that what is desperately needed is to look at the whole question of protein. When we use rather glibly in our devotions or in our sermons the statement that, you know, half the world is going to bed hungry, we are not really stating the truth, of course. Half the world is not right now going to bed hungry. But three-fourths of the world is going to bed without enough protein, which means something far more. Because it means that their whole innards and their minds and everything else are being affected because they just don't have enough of the nutrients to live with. And that problem is, of course, increasing more and more. Most of the world lives not on animal protein as we do. Most of the world wouldn't even want to for, I'm sure, many, many years. They live on rice in Asia, and they live on a little paste that's given to them in Africa, and they live on atoll and some other things in Latin America. And all of these things are very much deficient in protein. And so whatever foods are deficient in protein, usually they're deficient in many of the other essential nutrients as well. And so it is a peculiarly a food problem. And then when you look at the whole matter of agriculture, of course, the good Reverend Thomas Malthus showed us that the dilemma that we would come into in the world someday, his predictions of 150 years ago didn't quite work out the way he thought they were going to work out, so he kind of dismissed him. But he was a considerable person, and he saw things with a great deal of perception. And he saw, of course, fundamentally, that agriculture increases numerically, population increases geometrically. And I suppose you can explain that a lot of different ways. As one of the economic leaders in Africa said, it's a whole lot more fun to produce babies than it is to produce corn. I suppose that's one reason. But at the same time, it is true. And agriculture has been given the spotlight lately, in a very important way. I happen to feel very strongly that that's true. There are all kinds of economists and experts around and say, now, if you get hung up on this agricultural problem, you're going to just destroy the chance for any success. What we need is to set up a vast communications network. This is, after all, the age of electric media, as Raccoon says, and if we can just get enough communication going, then the people, you know, will be educated and things will change and all the rest automatically. Well, we used to believe things like that. Or if we can just get these nations on a takeoff basis, Roscoe used to say, industrially, then we can do something. But it is a strange phenomenon that it has always been true that agriculture is the base for industry. And so we have all kinds of smokeless chimneys standing in the developing world all over that have been planted there by their governments and by our government and by Western Europe and by communist Russia and by all the rest. Simply, they just didn't have the infrastructure, the kinds of things that could support industry, because, first of all, you have to build up an agricultural base in order to do that. And now, I think it's generally recognized, certainly by the United Nations and by our own Agency for International Development, the first priority is agriculture, and that we have to get at this business. Now, there are a lot of ways, I suppose, of attacking it. The basic way we've done it is to send grain overseas, and we know now that has been, in many cases, a mistake. Even though it fed some people, it also deterred the progress of agriculture, particularly in India, by our region and so forth, in a significant way. That is not, you know, the basic thing that's needed, is to send them grain. We said for a time that it's necessary to send them expertise, some technical aid, and that's terribly important. But the kind of technical aid that most of the developing world has wanted up to now is the scholar, you know, that's been world-renowned for 40 years, And so he sits in an agricultural school at the University of Illinois, and they've read his books, and so the Ministry of Agriculture in one of these countries asked if that particular man come over and help them develop agriculture. Well, it sounds good, but here's a man who has all kinds of theories about agriculture as it occurs here in the United States. He suddenly gets transplanted into a tropical land, where tropical agriculture, of course, is entirely different. He's got all kinds of theories. He's really a little old for going around and visiting, you know, the next farm right down the road. And so not a lot has happened because of that. And the cry now by the president's special panel that was set up in May of 1967 is for the kind of intermediate experts. And I would say, even as they have said, even the common dirt farmer in the U.S., as the Peace Corps has proven, can go over to these countries and help them significantly if they have the right attitude for one thing, which I hope their Christian, you know, convictions have brought them to. They're not going to patronize these people. They're going to recognize that those people are just as edgy towards us as anybody could be. They're also very skittish about trying new things, as you would be too if you lived in subsistence farming, and you know that if that thing just didn't work next year, your family would starve. And so we need that kind of technical expertise to come over there. And I'm amazed. I just met not so long ago with about 8 or 10 young farmers. They'd all gone through agricultural school. They're tremendously knowledgeable in agriculture. We started talking about some of this, and not too much longer, they had band together and said, well, you know, we could even work out a plan so that we could be gone for 6 months, and our farms could be run by our neighbors, and we could go over to one of these countries and do what we could do. And it was basically the Christian conviction that brought them to this. They're willing to pay their own money to do this. Whether it comes off, I'm not sure, but I think that's the kind of thing that needs to confront, especially a church that's very strong in the agricultural center here in the United States. We also then maybe just to get the facts straight, this has been called, the 60s are called the development decade, and we need to take the assessment, I think, seriously with the Food and Agriculture Organization and every other agency in the UN to say that we have dismally failed. There's the hope that we could raise agricultural production by about 4%. Well, across the board, we've done that. But the trouble is, and we use that figure all over the place, you see it in newspapers, we've really succeeded in doing it. We've done it in the U.S., we've done it in Canada, we've done it in Western Europe, we've done it in Russia. All of these places have increased greatly. The actual fact of the matter is that in every part of the developing world, that production has gone down. And then when you measure that over against the increase in population that's taken place in the last decade, you realize that per capita it's gone down even further. It is, I think, something that we need to recognize. Only 20 years ago, the developing world was exporting about 11 million metric tons of grain. And now they're importing about 25 million tons. That maybe tells us something about the fact that they're not doing too well in agriculture. And then as far as the population business, the significant fact here, of course, is that birth rates have not gone up greatly. In many parts of the world, birth rates, even with a great burgeoning of population, have gone down. The significant fact is, of course, that death control is being practiced now. Two major factors, babies are allowed to live. 50% of them died before, now most of them live. There were about 45 out of 1,000 births that were deaths, of course, only about 15 years ago in most of the developing world. That's now down to about 16 out of 1,000, while the birth rate stays about the same, 45 out of 1,000. Well, you see that really what we've practiced is death control. And largely that has happened. It's all a matter of hygiene and pesticides and all the rest, but it's largely happened because the Christian Church took very seriously the matter of medical missions. And we came over and experimented with a lot of this, and now, of course, it's taken over by governments and the rest. But I think somewhere along the line, maybe we have to ask the hard question of whether it is it is right for us as a Christian church to build a hospital somewhere where we know the death rate is going down significantly, and those babies will be allowed to live for 15 years, let's say, and then die a horrendous death by slow starvation because there isn't even a scrap of wood available to eat. I think we have to ask that question, or we have to take seriously some other things, like what is seriously being proposed of chemicals being put in the water to control population, antidotes being passed out by the government, sterilization programs. As you know, India is doing a lot of this, and it may sound rather terrible to us that a man is sterilized, and in return for this, he's given a transistor radio, which usually works for about 2 months. But that's common practice, and it shows a little bit of the desperation that these people are under. Unless we're willing to face this problem, of course, we will face even more grotesque solutions that are on the way, euthanasia and all the rest. Or you take the whole question of trade, which is, of course, a very complex thing, and believe me, there certainly aren't any easy answers here, but there isn't much willingness either to face the question, I think, it has to be said. I think the supreme proof of that was that probably the conference that has had more hope for the developing world of any conference that's been held, and this the developing world leaders have said themselves, was held last February, this past February in New Delhi, the UNCTAD conference, the Nation and Commission on Trade and Development, and it was the second conference of its kind. That's the newest organization among the labyrinthian organizations of the United Nations. But it also held the most promise because there was some new blood giving new thought to this. I ran into a dandy young Christian fellow who was in UNCTAD in New York, spent several hours with him, saw him translate his Christian concern into some very sophisticated business about world trade. This was just before he went over to New Delhi, and he really did have some great hopes because they'd taken about 4 years to carefully prepare some proposals for the developed world to face the problem of the developing world. Now, as every reporter that I read from that conference has said, every single one of those proposals went down the drain. The minds of the West were set in steel and of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union got as many brickbats from the developing world, the third world, as did the U.S. But that was one sign of hope. They're looking for such things as commodity agreements because many of these nations, as you know, are producers of primary commodities. And they often have only one or two commodities that the whole nation depends upon for its economic development. And when those prices fluctuate wildly on a free world market, supposedly free, really controlled by Hershey and Nestle's and some of those in the cocoa market, they tried for 3 years to work out a cocoa agreement, and it again was dashed in January when they were just on the brink of getting the thing done. In Ghana, all the money, and we sent, they said about $300 million into Ghana alone, all of that has been wiped out many, many times by the fluctuating price of cocoa, which has fluctuated wildly, especially for the last 5 years. So trade is a very important part of this whole business. Now, we have another myth in this whole matter of trade, and that is that we are developing substitutes for some of these primary commodities. We've been able to synthesize rubber and many of these other products, and so we kind of have the idea that we really don't need the rest of the world. Well, it's been said, and I would have no way of checking this, of course, it's been said by responsible economists that 50% of our production depends upon the raw materials of the rest of the world. We're living on their backs, literally, and that this will be true for many, many years in the future. Now, what the rest of the developing world is saying about this whole business, okay. If you don't want to trade with us, if you want to set up your Kennedy round in the Atlantic community and all the rest, you want to just look at that in a myopic way, then we'll go out and we'll go back and start digging our canoes out of the logs. We'll go back to a very, very primitive, fundamental economy, and maybe it'll take us 50 years, and many of us will starve to death in the process, but we will build up our own economy and not be dependent or conditioned by anything that the West or the Soviet Union or anyone else is trying to tell us to do. I think it's serious. It has, of course, other implications. All of the shipping, or 98% of the shipping, and 98.9% of the insurance rates, for instance, of all the goods that are carried back and forth, are owned by the West, not by the young countries. Well, there are many other areas that are naturally a part of this whole business. I suppose we could say it's kind of a grim picture, and certainly we need, I think, a period of repentance for that which we have done. But if we are going to be preoccupied with the grimness, and we're going to do as so many have done, like the most popular book around today, The Famine 1975 by the Paddock Boys. Besides, as I've said before, it having really some bad treatment of facts. Generally, of course, the perspective is right. There is a mounting development that is in this population food waste that looks very grim. And we're going to come to conclusions like they are, who are supposedly responsible men. We're going to pick out those countries that we want to pick out, and we're going to decide, you know, on a military basis, whether we're going to save this country or save that country or reject that country or whatever. That's the kind of picture that we have to face. There is a sign of hope. I don't think the super optimists or the super pessimists, of course, have much to say about this whole thing. I think we need to hang on to the hope that is there. I have a rather circuitous way of looking at that hope. I see, for instance, what's happening to the Church of Jesus Christ today in understanding, for instance, the fullness of the gospel, that we recognize that it is an integral part of the gospel in terms of our Christian relations. It also is an integral part of the gospel to let men be released, to plow into the issues of life, because those also affect persons, as Jesus Christ affects persons. And that fullness of the gospel, which is now being polarized in the church, and people are tearing itself apart. Carroll talks about himself as being a radical conservative, and Hayne talks about being, the liberal humanitarian, Christian humanist. I like to think of myself and talk about this. I suppose it's a semantic term, but we need a radical middle that will take the radical grace of God seriously and recognize also that the job of the church is to identify, as our Lord did, with the outcast of society, not to be hung up by some political philosophy we've got in our head that says that that's nasty and we're going to hurt people by it and all the rest. I think this lifts us out of whether we're Democrats or Republicans, incidentally, and that's why maybe the beauty of this particular issue, which is so wide, that it can give some new thought to the whole way the church relates. I think what's happening in the church, and for the first time now, some stewardship men from the 13 major Protestant denominations met in Minneapolis not so long ago, and all of them except one reported a downgrade, a significant downgrade, in the amount of money that's coming into these offices. They all had one conclusion. People are getting a little upset because the church is taking stands on, you know, believing that all men are created equal and that sort of thing. You know, that's not really proper to do for the church. And so they're not turning the money in. Membership is slipping. For the first time, the American Lutheran Church did not gain this last year. And that's true of most all of the other churches. For the first time in its history, the Presbyterian Church USA significantly lost membership last year. Well, this is happening. And of course, I would say it's a sign of hope. It's a sign that we're coming to grips with the realities of life around us, and we're realizing that the church isn't a country club. It isn't something that people just tumble into because, it's the thing to do today. We're recognizing that there's going to be a concerted group of people, a cadre of people who can wrestle with these things and wrestle with their conscience and influence the conscience of our nation and all the rest, and realize that these are issues at the heart of the matter. Whatever else we may say about the deplorable state of the church, and I suppose everybody indulges in this to some extent, but we have to say, and I think it sounds almost trite to say it, but the church is the most influential, single influential institution in this country. There is no question about it. You sit down and talk with, for instance, a congressman for a little while, and he says, I get all of these resolutions from church bodies, and I guess, I have to look at them, because he said, if they ever took this seriously, if they ever really went to their people and meant business on this, it would raise havoc in this country. It would be the greatest pressure group in the world. Well, maybe we have to examine our conscience and recognize that there are some things that we can do in terms of influencing this country. Certainly, at least, we can do a little propagandizing on the matter of world hunger, which is all I am really, is a propagandist planting a few seeds here and there, and I hope you will do a bit of that too as we together probably study this whole area a little bit more. Well, I should stop here at this time. I guess 9:15 is the next hour, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry, I didn't even notice you, but...
I want to ask a question that excites me about the 8 to 10 farmers. I mean, now there's a little brotherhood exchange that's got something with going with the medics. That had to happen outside the church. You know, we started up in our office there once, and we just started getting names to get it going. Here you've got something moving that, to me, is just exactly what I'm aiming for, and I think a lot of people are. I mean, here's something which I'm willing to go a lot of meal once a week to put the money over to help them get over there.
Yeah. This is another one. I think we could support some of these people there, yeah, Rich. You know, these guys are young farmers usually. They're just out of school. They're you know, farming their quarter of land, and they haven't got that much money, but some of them are willing to go. The other great thing along this line, which I, you know, is sort of a hidden agenda for me, but I would say that you know, what would happen if suddenly a great number of young people said, got hooked on this thing, that kind of consumed by it, like I am, a little bit, and said, you know, what can I do as far as my vocational choice? It's important that we get them to our seminaries, and you know, but in the mission fields, as we all know, there isn't much chance that they're going to go as missionaries. But if we could get the World Mission Office to think a little bit about this problem, which I've tried to do for the last 4 years, and project what kinds of needs they will have, or could use, And whether they work for World Missions, or whether they work for AID, or whether they work for the UN is immaterial, but to go into biochemistry, to go into demography, to very new science, and just stumbling along, they could have an exciting life and be, you know, of significant service.
Another question right there, Matt, is this available job on foreign fields?
Well, the National Council does a little of that. Our own office does not. They're working on it. They begin to see that this is important, and so they're going to try to do this, project their own needs 5 years in advance. I hope that comes about.
A couple of years waiting on the
call. Yeah, I know.
Dan Lee waited 8 years to go out,
right,
you know, on a technical basis. It's
right.
Ridiculous. You know,
it
who's
is.
Who's going to hang around like Dan? Only an unusually rare person.
Right.
This is an area of aeronautics, you know, and health. And we've got two still sitting up there that they're going out for... What is it, Virgin Islands?
Well, that's neat. You really have a good
decided
that
you're waiting.
You're looking into it.
Yeah.
And
then
the other thing.
Carpenter's like this year, the tripping fellow, Ralph Neal, and Orphan. They're willing to go. They're waiting, you might say, and waiting for an opportunity. These things come up, I think, in a number of areas.
Yes, great.
I think one thing that I want to make sure you have in the library. I wonder if you could just give us, say, the name of a couple of things that are, I know you were not intended to describe to, and it's appalling to me that we as church people are satisfied to describe to Good Housekeeping, McCall, Lutheran Standards, and the paper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the paper, and that's it. And then these other things that are, you know,
yeah, that's a good point. There is, of course, a whole lot of literature around. I think some of
them. You could tell us maybe one or two things that you feel would be good for people that are like us, who don't want anything to do.
Well, I don't either. That's why I subscribe to them. It's one of them is brand new. It's a new publication that I left over there. It's called Ceres, C-E-R-E-S. For you Latin scholars, non-Latin scholars. It used to be called the FAO Review. It's published by the Food and Agriculture Organization. The Food and Agriculture Organization, I might say happily, has had a complete turnover in its administrative staff. It's one of the oldest UN organizations that's got very sloppy and very, very fat and it needed this change. And series can be ordered if you want it for $2.50 from, of all things, the FAO Regional Office in care of the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
they happen to have headquarters there. They're not supposedly related to the USDA, but naturally that's the way world politics works. They also have an office, of course, in New York, but I think it's easier to get through them. That comes out of Rome, so it comes a little ways. The other magazine that I think of is a magazine called Edge. No, I'm only kidding. That's the youth magazine put out in the Missouri Synod LCA and ALC, but you will find many articles in that magazine about hunger, if I have anything to say about it, and we've gotten quite a few in so far. Actually, the UNESCO Courier is also an excellent article, excellent magazine. I think we do have to say about, you know, looking at this thing, if we read only that stuff that's from the U.S., we do get a different point of view. AID and USDA has a party line right now. They've hit it hard. We've got the capacity to feed the world. We've got the technical know-how to feed the world. And so we keep saying that over and over again, and we never do anything about it. Freeman was really caught with his pants down when he went into Vietnam just a couple, what was it, a month ago. Went around, and CBS followed him around in Vietnam on the pacification program. He came into Hawaii, you know, with a lay on, and he was interviewed, and he was telling about all the great progress that they're making. CBS showed the same tour that he took about 3 years ago and showed how in every place that he's gone, things have seriously deteriorated. Well, I think we have a myopia here that is really something we have to get out of. And the UNESCO Courier, which can be ordered from UNESCO at the UN Plaza in New York City, is another excellent article, an excellent magazine that carries a lot of development articles. Yes, Pastor Sager?
I was just thinking, I have a good friend who was over in New Guinea in 56 and 7, I think, and gave 2 years of his life in charge. He is one of the great leaders of church workers now. He's a builder and, overworked.
Mm-hmm.
2 years of our life, I would be twice the old that I volunteer myself.
Right.
Go along, encourage the work. The other thing that inspired me, I met some of the pastors, fathers, and sisters in college, and
young
people, going to New Guinea and give 2 years of their lives to teach the English language.
Mm-hmm.
These are the things.
Mm-hmm.
We live for Christ. We live for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I believe here is where we need to strive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And without apology, I say, the kids that are asking questions about this, seriously consider the Peace Corps. We make a lot of jokes about the Peace Corps. Boy, I don't think you can go into very many countries where these kids have made a fantastic imprint in those countries. Just talking with one of the girls whose boyfriend is over in Kenya now, or India, I don't know which, but, over in Kenya, they do not like Americans. Let's face it, they just don't, and they've got some good reasons for it. But those people just really glow when they talk about these Peace Corps kids. It's really a great thing. I don't think it's sentimental to talk about this at all. They have gotten in, and they have pitched in to those people, and they've gotten underneath their burdens, and they work. And not all of them, do this, but a major proportion of them. They screen them pretty carefully. They also have never become an instrument of American foreign policy. And that's a story in itself, which would be fun to talk about.
I'm thinking of the doctors,
yes,
nurses,
yes,
yes, farmers.
Skills that are needed very much. The problem is the money. If we could expand the money somehow, yes, I hope. Well, for one thing, 65 and 66 had very bad crops around the world. That was mainly weather things. But the other thing is that, we hear so much about miracle rice and about the tremendous hybrid that was grown and first developed in Mexico and now is being used in Pakistan. We hear these success stories. That's a very small amount of the total production of food around the world. I'm talking about the general statistics. We have plenty of stories to tell about great increases, but generally, the peasant cultivator who, for instance, AID brings down to Bolivia a steel plow, and the peasant cultivator has been using a wood plow for generations, oh, he's got that field plow up on his shack, you know, it's a beautiful thing, it shines in the sun, and but he's still using that. Now, we can laugh at that, but it's you know, it isn't that easy when you had the feel of that wooden plow all these years since you were a little boy, you know, to make those changes. So changes are not happening in agriculture as much as a lot of publicity would lead us to think, I think. I think there are some real signs of hope, but production actually has gone down. I would stress, though, however, that it's per capita food consumption that has really gone down because of the burgeoning population. The last 4 years, we have increased the world's population as much as all the people that live in the world at the time of Christ. You know, it took us how many millions of years to get the first billion in the middle of the 18th century, the second came in 100 years, the third billion came in 30 years, the fourth billion will come in 1975, which is 15 years away, the next one will come in probably 8 years, and by year 2000, it's projected, it will be about 7 billion. You know, if there's about 50% deficiency in food eating now, that the simple statistics are that because of doubling population in another 25 years, we've got to treble food production in order to get people even up to a bare minimum what we have to do. So this eats away at the problem. We didn't have that problem in this country. We've got to stress that. We did not have the population problem. We had a vast land. These people do not have everywhere to go at this moment. Yes? I didn't hear you.
Oh, you mean like Mary
giving
your father a hat?
No, that's okay.
Okay, I'm glad Tony watches those watches.
That's
yet.
All right. I have to
wait to turn
over, but I have one more.
Yes. Nobody, everybody else wants to go, Mary, but we'll turn off that question. Okay? All right. By faith, but we've gotten that money. Well, this is true.